In this last week of hosting the daily program, The Takeaway, we revisited some of my favorite segments from the past 10 years, interviews that have stayed with me and with so many of you. And a lot of you may have heard them if you checked out the podcast this week. But on this Weekender edition, we have at least one program that you haven't heard. And I think all of them are worth hearing again. I've done a lot of stories about the criminal justice system on this program. This one immediately comes to mind. It's about a man's struggle with the death penalty, but he doesn't live on death row. This segment aired originally on October 4th, 2016. For the first time since 1971, less than half of Americans support the death penalty. That's according to a Pew poll released last week, which found that 49% support capital punishment, 42% are opposed. Back during the height of the Vietnam War, America had a whole different concept of criminal justice. In the days of the gas chamber, the firing squad, the gallows, and the electric chair, there was a deliberateness about executing criminals that, as the war ended, Americans generally and gradually turned away from. Frank Thompson was fighting for his life as a soldier in Vietnam back in the 70s. When he returned to civilian life, he joined the Oregon Department of Corrections, eventually becoming top prison official in the state. As superintendent of the Oregon State Penitentiary from 1994 to 1998, Frank oversaw the state's only two executions in the last 54 years. And that's all it took for Thompson to become a changed man regarding the power of the state to take a human life. Thompson now serves as an advocate against the death penalty. But surprisingly, Thompson said that when he took the prison job a long time ago, the last thing he ever expected was to feel any misgivings about killing murderers.
So when I became a superintendent of the Oregon State Penitentiary, the notion of having to take a life was nothing new to me. I went into it prepared to do, as many soldiers do as they volunteer for our military, prepared to do what we need to do in our profession. Well, within 18 months, I was assigned the job of executing someone, and I had to assist in rewriting the policies and the procedures from death by gas to death by lethal injections. And it forced me to come to grips with how I really stood about the death penalty. And all of the flaws with the death penalty, one by one, just came into focus. And I realized that I was leading a group of men and women into the process of how to kill a person, how to take the life of a human being, in the name of a public policy that could not be shown to make the public any safer.
When you were doing that and you went home at night, did someone ask you, well, how was your day? And did it feel much different to answer that question when you were doing that versus a normal day at the Oregon State Pen?
I think only at home. We didn't talk about that side of my job. When they don't know what it is to walk inside of an institution every day and the door's locked behind you. And I wanted to protect my family, and it worked well. So I didn't get that at home. But on the job, now I tell you the point where the concern about each other's well-being sort of came to a peak. In the process of that first execution, I came to the realization that I was at my very core against the death penalty. And I don't supervise and guide people toward a goal, thinking one way and acting another. I have to be in concert. So I went to my staff and said, look, folks, I can't come to say that I support the death penalty. And I want you to know that. And I, under the law, the only person that was required to carry out the protocols of the death penalty was the superintendent. Everybody else volunteered. And I let them know that I would understand if someone opted not to go through with it. And I almost choke up at this moment when I think about to the person, because they believed in me and they believed that a stable society needed professionals who could do the tough work. They stuck with me all the way through. And it was at that time we sort of took inventory of how each other were doing.
If in your moral core it was wrong to you the first time, it must have been so difficult that second time.
It wasn't any easier. I was a soldier in the Vietnam era. I didn't believe in the Vietnam War. And I demonstrated against the Vietnam War after I came out. So in a very similar sense, between the two executions, I went to my director. And I actually said to him, I can do my job as long as I have an ability to criticize, knowing that the director was going to talk to the governor, and you know that's input. It takes an inside person to have that kind of a voice. That's one of the problems in this country is I feel anyway, we too often have to make changes from without, in the street, from the outside force. But if you have the capacity to make change from within, from a credible experience, that's the way to make a real difference. And I think I've laid some fingerprints in that area here in Oregon that I'm very, very, very proud of.
So let's say you encounter someone who has also been in military service and has seen suicide bombers in Iraq and their friends and fellow soldiers killed and maimed from IEDs, and they also are in the penitentiary, and they also encounter someone who has committed a horrible crime, and they say to you, I am so enthusiastic about putting this person to death. How could you possibly argue against it? What would you say to them?
I would say to them, I can almost relate to your feelings because I had a best friend. His name is John Tillman Hussey, who was a police officer who was abducted by felons who were attempting to avoid being captured, and they killed him. And I can remember when I was supporting the death penalty, hoping that those persons would get caught and that they would be executed. So I would say to that person, I understand those emotions, but vengeance does not make good public policy. Capital punishment is a public policy that is supposed to have an outcome that protects the public and makes it safer holistically.
And capital punishment doesn't make the public safer?
Oh, absolutely not.
Is there something about the manner in which their lives were extinguished that you retain as a particular memory?
Yes. During the process of one of the executions, one of the individuals let us know that the straps binding his hands to the gurney was hurting his hands. And I gave instructions to make adjustments so that his hands wouldn't hurt. And the adjustments were made, and he looked at me and said, thank you, boss. I think that's a moment where the humanity of individuals involved in a terrible process speaks out.
Frank Thompson, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to get this message out.
Frank Thompson was the superintendent of the Oregon State Penitentiary from 1994 to 1998. To give some context to Frank's point on public safety, murder rates in non-death penalty states are consistently lower than those with the death penalty. A recent survey of criminologists by the University of Colorado found that 88% of criminologists believe that the death penalty does not act as a deterrent for future crimes.
These Marines on patrol made contact with the elusive enemy.
The defense of freedom is everybody's business.
The United States has resumed full-scale bombing of North Vietnam.
American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people.
The Pentagon hoped to instill, quote, shock and awe.
This is a multiple allied interest.
We went into Baghdad, everybody celebrating. And then the war was very badly mishandled.
Reaching across war zones of time was a thought, a gesture, a moment we on this program treasured when we first heard it back on August 8th, 2013. We befriended two U.S. soldiers, one from the Vietnam War, one from Iraq, united by the experience of PTSD. Among the conversations I will always remember from hosting The Takeaway is this one. I suspect it will stick with you, too, long after I'm gone. As part of our focus on PTSD this week, we introduced former U.S. Marine Douglas Howell, who went to Vietnam in 1966 and 1967, to retired U.S. Air Force Captain Mary McGriff, 2004 veteran of the Iraq War.
When I was diagnosed with PTSD and depression in 2005, it was taboo. So even though I knew that I had the diagnosis, I refused treatment because of the stigma behind it. My husband and I knew that I came back changed. I was very depressed, cried a lot, didn't know why. It would just happen. So it wasn't until 6 years after that I actually sought treatment.
You know, half of people who are diagnosed with PTSD don't seek treatment. Douglas, how many times did you refuse treatment, would you say, if you can even count?
Oh, my gosh. Certainly more than 5 or 6 or 7, 8 times. Nobody ever told me that I had PTSD. I just thought I was kind of a screwed up kid, kind of living on the streets and hitchhiking around the country. I was doing an awful lot of drugs, self-medicating so that I could get through the day and night, and mostly the nights. And I also had a girlfriend and we had a child together. And I came home one day and I saw the child and I didn't like the situation that I had put the child in. And I began to say, I got to get my act together. I had seen any number of psychiatrists and psychologists over the years. Of course, none of them help until you really admit and want help. And you're the one that has to open those creaky doors.
Mary, what are you most curious about Douglas's experience? Go ahead and ask him.
Doug, do you feel like you have made a difference for yourself and for others?
I think that I am very proud of myself for standing up to this very difficult condition and facing it and dealing with it. And I feel like I'm happy to say that I have almost a normal life for having done that. The more I do it, the more I talk about it, the more I become comfortable with the ogre in the room, the more I realize that I would really like to do more for other people. I would like to do more to help find a way for people as myself and as you, Captain, to deal with this so that we don't have to go through that, is this someone I can talk to or is this not someone I can talk to? And how much can I talk about? And how in-depth can I go? And what do I say to them when they say I don't want to hear anymore?
What are you most curious about Mary's experience, Douglas?
I am curious about how she dealt with relationships, whether she has family and children, and how was she able to maintain that?
That was hard. Fortunately for me, and I know for many others, it's not the same, but I have a very strong and solid marriage. My husband has stuck by me since before I came into the military. So we've been married or together for over 20 years. Our relationship really didn't suffer. But what suffered is me struggling with my symptoms and trying to deal with it and be the strong one and be the leader that I'm expected to be. And it was a facade that not only did I have at work, but I had to have it at home. At least that's how I felt. But through treatment, my second psychologist, who was civilian, got me to the point where when she had me write my trauma account of what I experienced during my 4 months, she later then asked me, have you shared this with your husband and your kids? And I was just flabbergasted. I was like, what are you talking about? I would never share this type of detail and emotion with my kids and my husband. And her question was, why not? It was a burden. And I didn't want to burden anybody with it. But she got me through that stage in treatment where I had the nerve to actually read my trauma account, which is 5 pages, out loud to my husband. Then I let my children read it. Then they understood where I was coming from. But I have to accept the fact that I changed. That was the hardest thing. I will never be the Mary McGriff from before September 2004. It's just not going to happen.
Even though I have the effects of war, I'm always leery. I can't go out of my house without the 2 seconds that happen when you open the door. You plan your path to your car. You make it the most expeditious path you can because of that sniper that's going to be out there. Even now, almost 50 years later, it is a brief, fleeting moment, but it happens every single time if I open the front door to get a newspaper. But after that, I'm okay. I can do that.
That is one of the most, difficult challenge is when people think that PTSD is like a rash. It's going to go away. And it's not. So
yes, ma'am.
When people say get over it, or, oh God, it's been 50 years, you shouldn't be thinking about that stuff already. Those are the people that do not understand. And that is why I have such difficulty talking to people that did not experience what I did.
Any advice for this nation on what we're going to be dealing with over the next 50 years?
It's only going to get worse, because you still have people who are afraid to talk because they have their career or their next job to think about. You don't want to be perceived by other people as not being capable of doing certain jobs. You don't want to be judged by your condition. Doug, what do you think?
You know, I come to understand over the last few years that PTSD is not a black and white issue. You know, PTSD is this great, big, ugly blob of gray.
True.
I don't know what American can do. I think what they can do is listen. Listen.
Douglas Howell was a Marine corpsman in the Navy during the Vietnam War. He joined us from WDET in Detroit. And retired Captain Mary McGriff was with the United States Air Force serving in Iraq in 2004.
Since the interview, Douglas Howell has written a book about his experiences traveling back to Vietnam to find closure. It's called The Night is Dark and I Am Far From Home, a Vietnam veteran's trip forward into the past. This next story you haven't heard unless you heard its first airing on July 18th, 2012. And I think it's one of the most controversial we've ever done on the program. You'll soon find out why. But before we air it, think of yourself as a young doctor with a lot of ideas about what you're going to do in your life, in healthcare, how you want to help people. And then listen to this story.
Dr. Frederick Newman is the director of the Anxiety and Phobia Center at White Plains Hospital in Westchester County here in New York. But when he was a medical intern, he saw a baby born with a single fused eye in the middle of its forehead. Parts of its brain and skull were missing, and the child's esophagus had never separated from the trachea, making it unable to eat. It's a rare disease, fatal. It has a clinical, unpronounceable name. And so in the medical community, this rarity is called Cyclops Baby. Dr. Newman recently told this story in a blog post for Psychology Today entitled The Cyclops Child, and he picks up the story of the original incident more than 50 years ago and the extraordinary reaction he has received from sharing that story with the world.
I came into this experience a few days later when the baby in question was transferred to a pediatric service. I think in order to make this come alive, I really have to describe the baby. It's a grossly and grotesquely deformed child with an eye in the middle of its forehead made of the two fused eyes. No nose, head that was missing part of its skull and a considerable part of its brain. What I imagine happened is the obstetrician took one look at this baby, recognized it as a child that was not going to live. And I think what he imagined, what he planned on doing was sparing the family what would have been, in my opinion, an extremely traumatic situation. He anticipated probably that the patient would die in a few minutes or a few hours. That's what usually happened. And he told the parents that the child had died, but the child hadn't died. This child had other abnormalities other than the ones I mentioned. The baby had an esophagus that went right into the lungs so that there was no way of feeding it. There was never going to be any way of feeding it. We knew this child was doomed from the time it came onto the ward. But while we looked at the child and it was quiet, it was easy to sort of ignore it, frankly. It didn't look like a human being. But when it started to cry, it sounded like a human baby, and it tore at everyone's hearts. So this was a baby that could not be consoled. Certainly I tried on a daily basis picking the baby up and holding it, rocking it. Not only that, there was nothing else that could be done that we could see for this child. We had to essentially wait for the child to die. It was obviously suffering. The people around it, after a while, began suffering. After a while, the nurses sort of segregated themselves as far away as they could because this child was so painful to deal with. And the child continued to live without any sustenance day after day.
Over the course of how many days?
Over the course, as I remember, of about 13 days, it seemed greatly enlarged in my mind because it was such a terrible experience for everyone.
You, over the course of your medical career, came to have some judgments about what the doctor, the obstetrician, did in that initial particular case. Explain to me what you initially thought, how you came to maybe another view, and why you decided to share this story.
What I thought initially, holding that baby in my arms, is that the obstetrician had done the right thing. In those days, the expectations patients had coming into the hospital were somewhat different. And I thought that there's no question still in my mind that this woman looking at this child that had just come out of it would have been traumatized permanently. Now, a lot of people who have read the blog just can't believe that. An experience like this is so out of their experience. And one of the problems with the people relating to this post is that they see it sort of as an extension of their own experience, naturally. Mm-hmm. What do you do with a sick child? What do you do under certain extreme circumstances? And none of that applied. And I wasn't able, I think, in the text, and I don't really think it is possible, to make come alive the fact that there was nothing that could be done for a human being that we were holding in our possession and in front of us. And trying to help in one way or another. It could not be comforted. It could not be fed. It could not be calmed. It could. All we could do, short of killing it, which is something I thought about doing.
By yourself?
By myself. Really? That was the kind of thing that you couldn't involve somebody else.
At a dark moment on the ward, you might have...
Well, when I looked this up, I realized that one of these babies had not just lived moments, had lived a year. And I thought that some crazy medical person might think of putting a tube in the stomach directly, would have to go through the abdominal wall to keep the baby alive. And that would have been so terrible that I thought that maybe I should do something.
You know, you had the experience of holding the baby. You had the experience of seeing the baby. You had the traumatic experience of watching the baby die and of thinking through all of these questions in those 13 days. The individual who did not have that experience, though, is the mom. Is it right for a doctor to have made that decision to deprive that mother of that experience?
I think it is a debatable issue, and I have thought differently about it at different times. In the overwhelming experience of holding this child, I thought nothing could be worse for this mother. Even though she would have wanted to see the child, nothing could have been worse for her than seeing this baby. Now time has passed, I think that most people would have opted to see the child.
Mm. You know, this impulse of doctors to protect and to calculate that a certain experience would be so damaging, and you've used those words – is almost irresistible, I think, in the healthcare profession. I mean, you're about healing.
It's an everyday experience. Yeah.
Yet, isn't life about irrevocable change? Isn't life about experiences which push us to limits that we can't imagine until we get there?
What I was trying to indicate in this blog is that there are experiences that are so peculiar in their character, so distinctive, so unexpected, that the usual rules break down. And that people are finally left with the idea, what is the right thing to do in this situation? Now, a number of people have read this blog and are angry at me.
Why are they angry?
Well, I think they're angry for a number of reasons. First of all, there is a certain group out there that I really didn't know existed who are disabled, and they feel with good reason that they have been persecuted and treated badly because they're disabled or disfigured in some kind of way.
Or they're scared that some doctor is going to decide someday, that experience, not being able to walk
But judging from what they have told me on the blog, what they're really upset is the fact that they are not treated like human beings in some situation. I'm sympathetic to that, and I feel terrible that they see me now as almost the incarnation of those evil people. But it's not just disabled people. Every human being has an experience of a sick child or an elderly parent. Mm-hmm. So it's a live situation and a live problem. One of the reasons I wrote this blog is I wanted people to be able to think that maybe the way they thought about things might sometimes break down in certain situations. So I would say, well, what about this terrible situation? Do you still feel this way? Yes, I still feel this way. Well, what about this when this happens? Do you still feel this way? And they say, yes, they feel that way. And what I was trying to present is a situation which defied all of those plans and expectations and moral judgments. And someone is left with a kind of existential feeling about what should I do in this situation? And I don't pretend actually that I know or knew then what was right. What I would like people to know is that there is room for uncertainty and doubt. But a lot of people, this is a very simple matter. The Bible says this, and that's the end of the story.
Did anyone have the impulse during those 13 days to give that baby a name, or did it have a name?
You know, the baby did not have a name, and I have no memory of what sex it was. Mm. So this was a child that had no name, no sex, no ordinary existence, and yet, of course, it did have an existence. And voicing those kinds of thoughts is very upsetting to a lot of people, that this child was treated not as a child, but as a thing in some kind of way. And yet there is some element of truth to that.
Do you remember the moment the baby died?
I remember the baby at the moment I discovered the baby to be dead, yes. I felt relief. I felt sadness, of course. But it was awful for the child. It's hard to imagine a child that is not comforted by picking it up, that you can't feed it when it's hungry, you can't do anything for it, and it's an uncanny experience, and I've never had anything like that since then.
Dr. Frederick Newman is director of the Anxiety and Phobia Center at White Plains Hospital.
Since we aired this interview, Dr. Newman retired from the Anxiety and Phobia Center after being its director for more than 25 years. Back in 2013, we did a memorable series on caregivers, how so many Americans are doing an essential job that gets no notice, typically no pay or even help from the government. So many people reached out to us to share their caregiver experiences. Caregivers to wounded veterans, autistic children, to people on a suicide watch with a loved one. Bernice Osborne Pollard from Boston back in the summer of 2013 was still taking care of her mother Mary, who had Alzheimer's. It was at great cost to Bernice, she told us.
One of the things that I've definitely sacrificed is a career. Like, I haven't had the opportunity to develop interests that, you know, things that I even wanted to be able to pursue. And there was a time when I didn't think that I would be able to get married because I was like, who is going to marry me in this situation or have children? And I thought that that would be another one of the sacrifices. I was willing to make that sacrifice.
You
were? Thankfully, I was willing to do that. I mean, I only have one mother. You know, I'm not going to look back and say, oh, gosh, you know, I'm not a CEO of my own company because I took care of my mom. I don't think those are going to be the conversations that I have in my head.
You probably have tips for how to date when you're taking care of your mom with Alzheimer's, right?
Yeah.
No kidding.
How do you date when you are a caregiver? I actually met my husband in a bar. I know people say that they can't meet their future partner in a bar, but I would just say be honest about your situation and what that situation is. If it's the right person, they will be understanding of the role that you play with your loved one. They will be accepting of you as you are. And so it won't be an issue. If you're dating someone and it is an issue, then that's not the person that you should be dating.
Do you remember when you understood that your mother was diagnosed and that she would reach a point where she would need pretty much full-time caregiving? Did you see that point coming, and did you have to make decisions and think about what your responsibility was going to be?
I do remember there's been points where we, you know, my sister and I decided, well, I can't go back to work. Well, how can we go back to work? If I go back to work, who's going to stay home with mom? You know, who's going to watch mom? If we're at work, one of us is going to have to stay home. And so we both made the decision to work part-time so that we could keep her home and that we would be able to watch her, because at that point she was wandering. And then there was a point where she started to have seizures, and we didn't think we'd be able to keep her home, but We just made adjustments and ended up interviewing home health aides because we were burnt out. But we didn't know we were burnt out until that moment had happened where she had a seizure and she was in the hospital. And we actually got to sleep late. We got to sleep past 7:30 in the morning. And so we were like, hey, we're burnt out.
Want to hear a number?
Is it a good number?
It's an amazing number. I mean, you're one of, 14.5 million caregivers dealing with someone with Alzheimer's who each year give about 17.5 billion hours of unpaid care, not unlike the routine you've just described to me. Do you know what the value of all that is, estimated by, economists and all those smart people? $216 billion.
Wow. You couldn't pay me to do this, though, John. You couldn't pay me to do it because I would do it anyway.
Sure.
It's my mom. On the other side of it, though, I feel like there should be other supports in place to support people who are taking care of their loved one at home.
Is your mom there? So many people describe just how disorienting and heartbreaking the experience of Alzheimer's is for someone who, I imagine, you had a pretty close relationship with your mom, if you're doing this much for her at this point in her life. Is she there?
So she...
That's a tough one.
There are moments when she's there. But she doesn't speak anymore. And,
but Bernice, you're there. That's the amazing thing about the caregiver thing. You're there even though she's, and so heartbreakingly not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are moments where she is there. She used to smile a lot, and now she doesn't do that anymore. And, but my sister always sings to her, and when she does, she opens her eyes a little wider and she looks for us in the room. And so we know that that part of her is still there. But, there's not much there that's my mom.
Well, part of our mission this week to all the people that we've talked to is just simply to say, how's it going today? How's your mom doing today? What would your answer to that question be?
I would say she's stable. She's good. I mean, she's not in any pain or discomfort, and so for that we're thankful. So she's doing okay.
And you? How are you doing? How's it going today?
Today is okay. I've had better days for other reasons, but I'm doing okay today. I'm thankful to have my family, so I am doing okay.
What do you think your daughter will remember from this experience?
I hope she remembers how to take care of someone. So if she has to take care of her mom, she knows what to do. But I just hope that she remembers the compassion that we've shown to her grandparents, and that she repeats the same thing with her parents.
Somehow, I'm thinking she's probably going to get that message, Bernice.
Mm-hmm. I hope so.
Well, Bernice, the best of luck to you.
Thank you very much, John.
That conversation, part of our last week of Hockenberry, look back at some of the memorable conversations on The Takeaway is from July 2013. Bernice Osborne Pollard and her sister Brenda cared for their mother Mary up until her death in July of 2016. And finally, for all the dark topics on this show, and for good reason, because we live in tough times, tough and interesting times. isn't that a gift? It's supposed to be. But let's end on a lighter note, okay? A peek into the inner workings of The Takeaway. And you're not going to want this one to even end. We here always imagined The Takeaway as a program with a solid public radio mind, but with an expressive, maybe higher bandwidth voice and a completely new sound. Jake Howitt, our technical director, is way more than just the sound guy. That's right. With sound and a decent idea, Jay and I like to make audio production magic as much as we can, and we've been doing that since the beginning of the program. Jay, why don't you just come in here?
Okay.
We got away with murder on this show. People don't realize that.
We killed old public radio. We killed it dead.
I mean, remember the opens that we used to do? Some of the stuff.
Well, we used to combine things like Edgar Allan Poe and Public Enemy.
Edgar Allan Poe, America's Blackness, and the Raven.
While I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping.
Rapping. Gently rapping.
That's good. That's good.
That's good. I mean, I guess we were scared that people weren't going to stay tuned, so we really jazzed up the top of the show.
There's something that the kids say out there. To confuse is to get close to God.
So well, I think, we did some confusing things.
Yeah,
sure.
I mean, and that's part of it, right? You don't always want people knowing exactly what you're doing. You want them to figure it out, and our audience is pretty smart.
When I would come into the studio with like a bunch of instruments, would you be like, "Oh, great," or would you be like, "Oh, God, no"? What was it?
Maybe a little column A, a little column B.
We have a couple examples, right?
We do. Well, we have the one that got us in the most trouble.
Yeah, yeah, right. The end of the world as we know it.
That's right.
Some evangelist said there's going to be the end of the world that day, so we did a little song. I played all the instruments. Celeste was the co-host, Celeste Headley, and
not just a couple of guitars either. You came in and played saxophone. I think there might have been a flute on.
Okay, so John, you have any weekend plans?
No.
Really?
No. I mean, haven't you heard? It's the end of the world as we know it.
Doomsday comes out of the world.
Listen to what I'm saying. It's the end of the world as we know
dogs
it.
Dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
Aloha means goodbye.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
Nevermore. You maniac!
What kind of damage?
Total, sir.
My God.
That's why we keep all these instruments in here, too. People don't really, you know, we got this drum in here. We got a couple of xylophones.
I'm taking them all. They're packed up. Out of here.
The following takes place between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m.
Nuclear terrorism, dirty bombs, so last season rerun.
We don't take orders from anybody but the President of the United States. Now move.
An international conference at the White House claims it will finally deal with dirty bombs and terrorist nukes. Is the reality of nuclear terrorism just catching up to TV?
The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised. Will not be televised. Not be televised.
Photo ops and rogue nukes. 24 may be canceled.
Events occur in real time.
But nuclear terrorism may just be getting started.
The revolution will be live.
On The Takeaway. We used everything. Well, TV shows, canceled stuff, anything. Sometimes, though, I mean, it just fell in our lap.
War! Are you ready?
Imagine abolishing the IRS. Imagine it's 1775. I am announcing that I'm running for President of the United States.
I do care. Obama cares
anymore.
Obama cares.
It's Obamacare.
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 I eat breakfast 300 yards from 4,000 Cubans who are trained to kill me, so don't think for one second that you can come down here, flash a badge, and make me nervous.
Hey, the Pentagon doesn't need Jack Nicholson to express its disapproval over the latest classified leaks about Gitmo prisoners. News organizations open the thorny question of who stays and who gets released from the world's legal black hole called Guantanamo. The story of more than a few scary men. On The Takeaway.
Did you order the code red? You did order the code red, didn't you?
Did.
We used a few good men.
Yeah.
Dozens of times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Although dozens of times.
That gets used a lot. That's,
oh, yeah.
That's a part of Americana. That's kind of like the Lincoln Memorial.
To be clear, it's important to give credit where it's due. The first technical director of the show, his name is Dylan Keefe, and yep. He's now the Radiolab's sound designer. The other guy on the show
There's
that I've worked
no
with.
No way he has as much fun on Radiolab as he had with us.
Well, he doesn't no get way. To make a show every day.
Yeah. That's true.
There's also our man Vince Fairchild, yep. Who's been our longtime sound designer engineer.
Vince created our crashing of the George Clooney fundraising Hollywood party for Barack Obama's 2012 election.
That's right.
Now, where is the host, Mr. Clooney?
For such a smart person, you really are lost, aren't you?
Well, hi, George. Who wouldn't be lost in a place like this? I'm not lost. I'm just looking for the way to the bathroom. Tell me how to find it.
This place houses a security system that rivals most nuclear missile silos. Through these doors, each of which requires a different six-digit code changed every 12 hours. Past those lies the elevator. This is where it gets tricky.
Whoa, George. Hey, you know, some little powder room, like a half bath, is fine for me.
The elevator shaft is rigged with motion detectors. Two more guards with Uzis and the most elaborate vault door ever conceived by man.
You know, I think I'll just hold it. I love that. I just, you know, taking stuff out of context. Oh, I'll miss that. I'll miss that.
You got to take people places, you know, even if they're not exactly totally real.
Welcome to another edition of Takeaway Travel. We're live on the eighth moon of Upsilon Andromeda D, a gas giant approximately 10 times the size of Jupiter.
Whoa.
See that breathtaking sky? Each day, this moon has that and a planet rise. Beat that, Cancun.
What was your favorite thing to make on this show?
Favorite thing to make? I think it was just the idea that we could do anything. The idea when you come in the morning, it was like anything could happen. Within reason. There's a pile of executive producers who could say, no, it's not anything. But
where are they now?
You know? Where are they now? Just make sure you have fun on this show without me around, all right?
I'll try, man.
You try?
Thank you for everything, man. All this sound design is, you know, part of your brain's in it. So that's our goal. Keep it going.
All I will say is carry on.
All right, man. I'll see you on the other side.
That was Jay Cowett, sound designer and technical director for The Takeaway, who is not going anywhere, by the way. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Hey there, guys. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks for always listening. Every time you decided to take our podcast, take any of our programs, check out the website, be a part of this community called The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and this will always be The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.